This is Grant Irvin, and welcome to the Grant Street Experience. This is our first kind of COVID version of the Grant Street Experience. I have with me today Rebecca Kiernan, Principal Resilience Planner at the City of Pittsburgh. Hello, Rebecca.
Hey, Grant.
And I also have a good friend and colleague, Peter Walker, with us. Peter, how are you today?
Pretty good. Hi, Grant.
It's good to see everyone. So this is we always kind of introduce this as an experimental podcast, and this is even a bigger experiment now that we're not in the friendly confines of the Fred Rogers studio. Peter, you are our first kind of specimen, if you will, in terms of this new experiment as we're recording remotely. And we also have kind of Bill, Joy, and Alex, our production team, behind the scenes here with us. So they're helping to manage sound quality and make sure that we keep on track. But we want to thank you for joining us here today in this this kind of new world. How have you been faring?
Well, now the weather's good. It's okay. We've got a bit of a garden around us, so I can get outside, and we keep chickens, and I do a lot of woodwork. So I get banished to the woodshed whenever I'm irritating everybody in the house, right? So it's okay. You know what amazes me? It's how quick it becomes normal, right? I remember the first time we went out wearing a face mask in the shop, and you felt like a right idiot. And now it's just what you do, right?
It's
amazing how quickly we adapt.
So one of the things, and we kind of, what we're, Rebecca and I have planned out here over the next couple of weeks for the Grant Street Experience, is to take a deep dive into the world of both resilience and the world of COVID. You know, most of our programs thus far, we've done, what, three, Rebecca, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Three,
yep.
Shows. They tend to be lighthearted just because of the nature of, I guess, who we are and some of the topics that we deal with. So we don't want to veer too far away from that, but these are serious times and serious topics. So we kind of wanted to, for listeners, share some of the, you know, kind of intricacies of a challenge of a pandemic. And you're one of the kind of principal advisors that we've had on our Resilient Pittsburgh project. So we wanted to kind of start with you. Can you share a little bit with folks kind of your experience and backdrop of your career before you came to Pittsburgh? Because a lot of that is relevant today, not just in terms of, you know, kind of the advisement that you provide us at the city, but you have a great kind of story before Pittsburgh and while you've been here. But maybe for listeners, can you share some of that?
Sure. So as you can see, I work for Chatham University now. I'm the Dean of the Falk School of Sustainability, and we're based up at Eden Hall, which is a little bit north of Pittsburgh. So everything we do up here is about how do you build more sustainable societies. It's about renewable energy. It's about new forms of economics. It's about food chains, all that stuff, right? But most of my life, I worked in disaster response internationally for international NGOs, for the International Red Cross. So whenever there was a major famine or a flood or an epidemic or a fallout from a war or something like that, I'd be part of the team that went out to look at that or to eventually evaluate it. So in some ways, when COVID struck, for me, it was almost like, oh, it's just like my old job back. You know, I felt myself going back into those old disaster response behaviors of, you know, okay, we're not going to get perfect information. We've got to go with what we've got, and it'll be different tomorrow morning, but that's fine. That's just the way we have to respond. And in many ways, I think what's amazed me is just how similar disasters and these crises are around the world. You know, whether it's, I did a meningitis epidemic in Ethiopia, and it was all the same stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you keep things clean? How do you trace people? How do you try and make sure that you're getting that mythical R number down so the rate of reinfection decreases? I mean, the scenery is different, but issues are the same. Yeah.
You also had experiences in Rwanda, was that correct?
Yeah, I worked in Rwanda immediately after the genocide. And I mean, that was a fairly traumatic place to work with the amount of, not just the amount of killing that went on, but the effect that had on people. You know, to find a country traumatized, quite something. But one of the things that I learned out of Rwanda was you can rebuild. So there's a little country with an eighth of its population macheted to death. Just unbelievable violence. And yet they have rebuilt, and they've almost leapfrogged from a peasant economy to a tech economy. Mm-hmm. And it was great leadership. It was people who were willing to take a risk and said, look, we can't be much worse off than we are now. And after this, if we just do what every other country does, it's going to take us decades and decades. So they pushed like crazy to get broadband access into the country, to educate their workforce. And they're now one of the success stories of Africa.
So in many cases, did they use the crisis as an opportunity?
Yeah. And you see that in many countries that, I mean, there's a couple of ways of looking at it. One is, which is sort of the Machiavellian way, is when people are frightened, they'll cling at any lifeboat. So you can sort of suggest stuff in a crisis and people will go for it. Now that's a bit, you know, it's maybe not the approach it, but the other way is people are willing to take risks if the alternatives don't look much good, right? So one of the things I'm thinking about at the moment is, do we really want to go back to having everything just the way it was in November and December? Mm-hmm. And so the next time we have a crisis, we have to go through all this again. I mean, it doesn't really matter whether it's a pandemic or it's an economic crisis or it's an energy crisis. For me, there's a moment of opportunity now to think about how can we use this and to use this opportunity to rebuild, if you like, Pittsburgh, to rethink how our economy and our society works. I mean, it's our city, right?
Right.
Nobody says you have to run a city this way or that way. We can decide how we want to do it. It just needs, a lot of it's to do with will, right? Willpower.
But to go back for a second, though, there's kind of these types of events, pandemics or floods or whatever the shock is, they have a cycle to them, right? You know, there's...
Sure.
Could you talk about that? I mean, there's the event itself, but then, you know, what should we start to anticipate in terms of the what comes next, even if we're right in it now?
Well, I mean, the usual thing, so let's forget things like floods and earthquake, which just hit you, bam, and you know when it hits. But disasters that creep up on you. The first stage is usually with people like you and me and Rebecca screaming, you know, the sky's going to fall, right? We're going to have a crisis. And people are looking out of the window and saying, I don't see any crisis. And that's what you had at the beginning of this pandemic, right? It's really difficult to convince people of a crisis unless they can touch it. Mm-hmm. Unless they have friends who are suffering, unless they lose their job. I mean, we're not stupid. People want evidence, and they won't just believe it because somebody in the city says it's a crisis. So that's your first stage, right? And then it hits. And that's the stage at which it's, well, we got to act fast. We've got to close things down. We've got to get the protective gear out. It's all about, if you like, the emergency. Decisions are taken quickly. They may not always be the right decisions. You may not have enough information, but you go with your best guess. And you're usually revising your plans twice a day in that period. And what you're really trying to do, and there are actually international standards around this, is say, what is the essential stuff we have to keep going? People have got to have water. They've got to have food. They've got to have healthcare. They've got to have shelter. Right? Those are the things that you absolutely try to keep going. You're interested, does transport keep going? And maybe a little bit later, well, what are we going to do about education? So it's all that sort of really important stuff first. As you're doing that, and once you're sort of, okay, nobody's going to, we've got the death rate under control, basically. Mm-hmm. Then you've got to start thinking about how do we get out of this hole? Mm-hmm. right? And that's where we started, you know, here in the city and in Pennsylvania. You know, we've got our color coding. We've got this idea of, well, some businesses will be allowed back, and gradually you start to climb out of this pit that we're in, as it were. And then finally, it's, okay, well, we don't particularly want to get into this mess again, so what do we do that's different? And the trick is that these aren't like a sequence. Really, you need people thinking about how do we get out of this hole from the moment the disaster hits. Because otherwise, you're just the way our brains work. We focus on the immediate, and we dismiss the rest.
In a case like, you don't want to get caught flat-footed, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you want to get started thinking now about what could we change? What's in our power in Pittsburgh to change that will make us more resilient for the next crisis or the next round of COVID? Because, you know, if you talk with most of the epidemiologists, this is not a one-off thing.
There's more coming.
Yeah.
What are some of the things, and Rebecca, be interested in your, you know, chime in on this, because, you know, you've done a lot of the modeling, but what are some of the things that you guys have seen, not so much that has surprised you, but like understanding like the stressors that are impacting a city like Pittsburgh? What are some of the things that have kind of become more apparent or come front and center with regards to being exposed through this crisis that, you know, effectively, like you said, we've known through kind of research and community conversations and a lot of the work that folks have done around the city for a long time, where our weak spots are. But what are some of the things that have really kind of percolated to the top?
Well, I don't know what you think, Rebecca, but, you know, what I've seen is, again, you see it in almost every disaster. Put it bluntly, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Those who are already vulnerable suffer most. So if we say, where have we had most infection? We have the highest death rates. It's in the poorer communities that have less access to healthcare. People are already vulnerable, right? If your immune system's already weak, if you don't have good access to healthcare and you don't have good access to nutrition, of course you're going to suffer more. So I think that's the first thing that we really understand, that those underlying issues of inequity in the city just fuel these crises. And then there are the hidden things that we should have known, but we don't always think about. So when you ask people to shelter at home, you've sort of got this assumption that home is safe. Well, what happens to women who are suffering from domestic abuse? They're now stuck with that person who's doing the abuse, right? Or kids who have been in families that can't cope. So there are all sorts of little things start coming out of the woodwork, you know, black swans, as they say, things you didn't know existed until you see it right in front of you. And then you got to cope with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Rebecca, what's your take on it?
So when we first did our resilience strategy work, we identified our top shocks and stresses. And this was through, you know, significant research and then a lot of community engagement and outreach and focus groups. But I think it's been really interesting for me to kind of go back and see what we had identified. And you can see that there is that disease outbreak and pest infestation was kind of like a little blip in, you know, our predictions from 2015. This started in 2015. And what we had been talking about, you know, one of the major themes throughout resilience planning is that stresses, we're a more stressful city as, you know, Pittsburgh we'd identified. So, you know, we have economic and racial inequity was kind of the largest issue that we came up with. Aging infrastructure, environmental degradation, lack of affordable housing, mobility and transportation access, food insecurity. And what happens in, and then fragmentation was another one that we kind of added later as a major stressor. So, having so many different municipalities, 130, in Allegheny County, you know, 3,500 nonprofit organizations that operate within the city of Pittsburgh. You know, just some of that regional fragmentation kind of, doesn't necessarily it makes it more complicated to get the services that residents need to those residents, right? Because it has to filter through.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, one of the major themes that we had looked at in resilience planning is how stresses, how shocks, when shocks hit, how they're impacted by how those stresses kind of interplay with those shocks, mm-hmm. right? So all of your stresses are then exacerbated. And you can, I mean, we can kind of see where those issues are playing out. So food insecurity obviously was a really big one. Economic and racial inequity, that's a, you know, a huge one. That's, you know, those disparities are really coming out right now. But then also, you know, the housing issue. So we've been talking a lot about this lately. There's an issue of energy poverty in Pittsburgh. You know, a study came out a few years ago that Pittsburgh is the sixth worst city for energy burden. So that's the percentage of your income that you're paying towards your utility bills. And as more people spend time at home, because our houses are so leaky, but you know, those bills are going up because you're not spending time outside of the home otherwise. So a lot of those housing issues, the aging housing stock, you know, poor environmental quality within your house, those are really huge issues right now.
You know, one of the things you don't have, well, you've got it under infrastructure, but one of the things that struck me as we shifted our university from, you know, teaching students in front of us to teaching online is internet poverty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that we've got, and this is way worse for kids who don't get to university, for kids in high school. You know, suddenly we're all trying to teach online. Mm-hmm. And I would make a fair bet that we will see online take up a larger percentage of our education when we return to whatever the new normal is. And yet, internet is a luxury in many areas of Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. It just shouldn't be that in the 21st century. It should be alongside water and electricity and sewage as an essential utility.
Is it? I totally agree with that. I mean, one of the things that's interesting in that sense too, is that that's a solvable challenge, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not well, many of these things aren't technically complicated. It's, you know, what's the political route that'll allow us to get there? Who pays for what, you know, and how do we pay for it? And in many ways it's a mindset. Do we see this as a service people have a right to, or a product people have to afford?
Right.
Right. So is this like education, or is this like a motor car?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's one of the fascinating things. I mean, it goes back to kind of one of your things you were saying in the opening, right? Like the, you know, the issues of kind of wealth and how wealth can alleviate you from a lot of the potent risks that are out there in a situation like this.
Yeah.
What's your take though? I mean, and this is kind of the interplay of the struggle with that, with like the, you know, the transactional versus the transformational responses, right? Like take the broadband internet, and I'd be curious on your take with this. You've seen a lot of NGOs and organizations step to the forefront to help kids with, you know, whether it's a hotspot or a laptop to help provide that. I would call that kind of the transactional.
Yeah.
But what's it take, you know, using kind of your experience in whether it's, you know, Rwanda or other situations, to get to the transformational, you know, to fix the underlying stress, but also set yourself up for, you know, what we talk in the resilience space, not just bouncing back, but bouncing forward.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because the internet's already well established, obviously, across the country, across Pittsburgh, and it is established as a profitable service,
mm-hmm.
right? What we're really saying is we need to tweak it a bit. There sort of needs to be a section in there which also says, and our goal should be that everybody in Pittsburgh has internet access, has the ability to have internet access, and that corporations have got to build that into their development plans. Mm-hmm. So if I was running Verizon or AT&T, I was saying, okay, who's going to pay, mm-hmm. right? And where's the legislation that's around that? Is there anything we can do at the city level to encourage the expansion of broadband into areas that presently don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
We won't get it unless we have got, people who want it lobbying for it, a city that's administration that's willing and able to create the environment that facilitates it. And that's what, bureaucracies often do. And then the industry that's open to finding ways of making it work. Because, I would bet this, in terms of percentage profits, this is probably not a big deal.
Not monetarily, right?
No, right. It's just a matter of finding a way of doing it. And it's, for me, it's one of the obvious things coming out of this crisis. If you had to say, let's pick a few things which we as a community of people, businesses, and governance can do in Pittsburgh to show that we're serious
mm-hmm.
about making our city more resilient, setting a goal for increasing internet access would be an obvious one, because there's so many other benefits from it. Our educational system benefits, our percentage of startup companies benefits, our ability to spread messages during a crisis, what's not to like?
Yeah, it creates kind of a win-win-win-win scenario, right?
Mm.
Rebecca, you just brought up food. And that's the other one that I think is, in our space, I can't call it shocking and maybe sad to say that, because we've understood these vulnerabilities. But if you talk to, as I talk to my neighbors, I mean, this is one of the things they can't believe, some of the scales of the challenges. You guys at Chatham have had a lot of great experience with food systems and understanding kind of, one of the premises of the Falk School, right?
Yeah.
On the Eden Hall campus. What are some of the things that have, both seen as like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening, but also how do you start to correct some of those?
Yeah. So this is a tricky one, isn't it? So do you know where most of our food comes from, Grant?
We actually just, I have some answers on that, thanks to our friends at the Tepper School. But
okay, so be knowledgeable. Where does most of Pittsburgh's food come from?
So one of the pieces of the research that Ed Rubin over at Carnegie Mellon's Tepper School, we had a class with them, and the majority of food comes from outside of Allegheny County and outside of Pennsylvania.
Most of it comes from California.
Most of it comes from California.
Most of the veg, anyway.
Most of the veg comes from California. Mexico is actually also a large importer. But the average vehicle miles traveled from food, and this is distribution hubs, is over 800 miles.
Most people in Pittsburgh have never had a fresh egg.
Yep.
Yep. Because those eggs are going to be 3, 4, 5 days old minimum before they get into the shops. Right.
Now, Rebecca has, though, because she has chickens.
Yeah. Well, I've got chickens as well. And and I can tell you when you're baking, that's so different. But here's the thing. There is a reason that our food comes from so far away. And that's because of economies of scale.
Mm.
You've got somewhere like Central Valley in California, which is perfect for growing salad. Right. And you can have these vast farms, which are essentially run by machines. It's cheaper to produce food there and ship it than it is to produce it locally, right? Mm-hmm. So economies of scale, same with pigs. We've got these vast pig farms around the country, right? Which then go to the slaughterhouses supply to us. It's an economy of scale. The thing about those systems, and if you like these, they give us cheap food.
Yeah.
Right. But the downside is they're not very resilient. So we're seeing this with the pig industry at the moment. Slaughterhouses have become one of the main places for spreading COVID. Mm-hmm. Many of them are shutting down. There are pig farmers across America who are having to euthanize thousands and thousands of pigs. Wow. Because they can't get them to the slaughterhouse, because the system starts to break down. If you're going to make a more robust system, there's essentially two ways of doing it. One is to put in lots of fail-safes and alternatives And in many ways, that's why military systems are robust, because they've got backups and backups and backups. That's more expensive, right?
Mm-hmm.
It will give you a more resilient system, but it's more expensive. The other way is to have less points of failure in your system. And that really means switching, in a sense, back to local economies. And that's one of the things that I think we should be pretty interested in Pittsburgh, because we're, in a way, we're lucky. We still have family farms. Mm. I mean, I'm 18 miles north of Pittsburgh. I'm looking out my window and I can see two family farms from here. One of which is still a tradition, one of which is converted to organic farming.
Mm.
And that's allowed them to make a living where 10 years ago, they were just going downhill and their land was going to go to property developers. So at Chatham, one of the things we've been looking at is how can you encourage the building of local food economies so we get closer links between our local farmers, our supermarkets, our restaurants. And if you do this right, everybody benefits. You get good quality food. It's a lot fresher. It feels better if you know you're supporting your local farmer. Mm-hmm. Restaurants get better assurance of the quality of their food because they can actually go and see where it's been grown and talk to the people. But it's a different way of doing business, right? And it may mean that food is slightly more expensive. We forget how cheap our food is. If you go back and look at the percentage that your parents and your grandparents spent, the percentage of their income on food, it's considerably more than we spend.
Interesting. Yeah. Is that, you know, part where you see like the interplay between sustainability and resilience, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's that people who do sustainability, a lot of us get terribly obsessed by systems. You know, we're always looking for these connections between everything and figuring out where are the weak links and how can we reinforce things. And resilient systems is really what cities, good cities, are built on.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want systems that collapse at the first shock. You want systems that have backups, that have got alternatives, that are robust, right? But like everything, it's not perfect. There are trade-offs. Mm-hmm. They may cost a little bit more, or they may cost more upfront. Like, think about renewable energy, okay? Being able to draw energy from the sun in your backyard is more resilient than having to rely upon three or four companies to dig the coal, transport it, burn it, supply it to you, okay? Mm-hmm. But you got to pay a bit more upfront.
To put that infrastructure in place.
Yeah, you got to put the infrastructure in. And then after a few years, it's paying you back, and your electricity bill's gone down to $25 a month, right?
It's amazing to see that, you know, those systems and how they interplay. I mean, the other thing that we found in the CMU research with Dr. Rubin too, is the amount of emissions that come from local trips in gathering food, which has been another part. And, you know, our colleague Shelley Danko-Day is our food policy guru, I call her. You know, one of the things that we've seen in this is the issues of kind of food deserts and the difficulty because of topography and locations and, you know, institutional inequalities and things of that nature that have been in place for a long time, but really start to come home in this crisis because of that challenge of local transport too. So the ability to get, I'm name dropping here, but another one of our team members, Will Bernstein, is working on a short distance trip program with our Department of Mobility and Infrastructure. First, you know, the idea is that the majority of short distance trips in Pittsburgh are under 3 miles, or the majority of our trips are under 3 miles.
Yeah.
A lot of that has up and down a valley, but, a lot of those trips are to go to the grocery store to get food or.
And have you seen that changing with COVID? I mean, it's really struck us how we used to go 3, 4, 5 times a week because we ran out of one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's once a week with a list.
I think the two things that you see is you see more bulk buying.
Mm.
You know, that's just anecdotally per our household. But also I think one of the things that the CMU report also kind of leads to is this idea of, you know, effectively delivery. right? Yeah. So kind of the online portion, like education, there's a certain kind of economy of scale to reduce those trips by directing, either reducing your trip or having it delivered, which has a kind of value benefits to it.
As someone that has worked in the food industry in the past, and in particular as a checkout at a grocery store, I think it's really important not to lose sight of the fact that a lot of people get their social interaction by going to the grocery store. So we really, I think, need to be, at least conscious of, the fact that a lot of those social connections are breaking down because people can't just go to the grocery store and schmooze with the person that's working there.
It's a sort of chicken and egg thing though, Rebecca, isn't it? I mean, because we go to the grocery store and we see our friends there, we socialize there, right?
Yep.
Whereas if that wasn't our pattern, that's not the way we would do it. We'd do it somewhere else. And when I was a kid, I was brought up in Ireland, not in Pennsylvania. And I remember my mom used to put in a weekly order with the grocer in the local town, and they would deliver. And in many ways it was like a forerunner of Amazon before anything. And so the grocery store wasn't something you even thought about socializing. There are other areas you use, but it just shows that none of these are simple. Well, in a sense, the problem is simple, but the solutions throw up lots of little complications as you go along. It's probably why it's such an exciting field to work in, because it's nothing is obvious. You find a solution and then you think, oh, but it also causes this. And then there's another little bit comes in. And it's like, we're like every university in Pittsburgh now struggling to think, what the heck do we do come fall?
That actually kind of leads into one of my next questions. I go back to your remark about black swans. One of the things that when we did the community outreach for the One Pittsburgh plan, having grown up here and in southwestern Pennsylvania, I always have kind of the steel and industry kind of in my mindset. And the idea of a major economic collapse was something that back in 2015, we did a lot of the engagement, Rebecca, wasn't top of people's minds. What happens if a major industry were to fail, or in particular, the thought about kind of the educational and medical institutions and how they play such a prominent role. You're kind of at the epicenter of that. Could you talk about, what some of the thinking that's happening at an education institution and some of those challenges and both how you're preparing for, the near term as well as kind of the long term?
Well, this is like a work in progress, right?
Because real time.
I mean, one of the things it opened my eyes to was just how big education is in Pittsburgh. I mean, we've got in the greater Pittsburgh area, we've got 160,000 students. The education sector probably puts about $9 billion a year into the local economy. And there are places around Pittsburgh where students, university and college students make up anything from 14 to 28% of the population. So this is, this is a big deal, right? Colleges. Right. So most universities are planning now, there's really two scenarios. The worst case is we do what we're doing at present, which is we offer classes online. We come up with interesting ways of doing labs. So with a lot of our ecology labs and biology labs, we've been preparing little take-home kits and having those posted to students. You can buy a reasonably good microscope now for like $20, right, on Amazon. So it's sort of affordable. You can give a microscope a little dissection kit, do it at home, that sort of thing. Instead of all having a field trip together, go find your nearest bit of open ground and identify plants there. So there are ways in which you can provide an online education and supplement it. But what it doesn't give you, and this is what really worries me, is university is not just about learning stuff, right? You don't just go there to learn biology or to learn physics or accounting. You go there to learn how to become a good citizen in a democracy. So how do I have a disagreement without losing my cool? How do I work in a team? How do I make my case, but understand sometimes I get it wrong and I've got to admit it? You know, all these skills are skills you tend to learn at university, and they make you a good citizen. And mm-hmm. it does worry me that if we have to go to online for any length of time, kids are really going to miss out on that. And that's a shame. So
the social interaction component.
Yeah. It's almost civics, right?
Yeah.
You learn how to be a good citizen in that period between your late teens and your early 20s. So what most universities are hoping is that they will be able to open up in fall, but to do so with basically social distancing in place, which means, well, we looked at our classrooms and essentially it means cutting the number of people in a classroom by half. Wow. And then you've got more or less 6 feet between people, and then having people wear masks on campus, a big cleaning regime. So probably what you would do is get the students to clean down their desk area before the class, clean it down after the class, as well as having a system of cleaning. Then it throws up all sorts of things. So if you halve the number of people in a classroom, where do you put the other students?
Mm.
Right? So nobody's got, 150% spare room capacity.
You have a finite amount of space to work with.
Yeah, too. Right. So you start thinking, well, one of the things we might do is one class, you'll have it on the ground with the teacher, and then the next one, you'll be online. You'll be using Zoom to hear the lecture, and then you'll flip, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that the classroom gets, you only have every other week, you're in the classroom, as it were. Another way is to go to shifts. That's how factories cope with not having enough space. So maybe you start your morning shift at 7 o'clock and run till 3, and then you have another shift. But if you do that, do you have to double the number of faculty?
Mm.
So it really is interesting how it pans out. The thing I think many universities are worrying about is, so you got to understand, apart from the really big universities, most universities almost operate on cash flow. Money in, money out. There's very little reserve in universities' budgets. Yeah. And so any fall in the immediate cash flow is a real issue. So if we see 20% of students saying, you know what, I'm going to delay coming to university for a year till things settle out, that's a huge loss of cash. It's not just the fees, it's the accommodation that's lost.
Right. The room and board and
the room and board and all that. And, I can see if it goes that way, this is going to be a big stressor for many of the small colleges mm-hmm. in our region because they don't have large cash reserves.
And the issue too, I remember seeing, was it Peachy, the Pittsburgh Coalition for Higher Education, I think they put together some information, this is almost 20% of the GDP of the city is, the 50 plus colleges and universities, throughout the region. That's not just Pitt and Carnegie Mellon and Chatham and Duquesne, big ones like that, but you also have, smaller post-secondary and forms of education that are also impacted by this.
Yeah, you got training colleges, you got for-profit universities. As you said, it's about 50 across the region. So it's a big sector of the population. And, if you project this out, when we're already seeing this, the last 2 or 3 years, we have seen some of the smaller liberal arts colleges having to close.
Already, right?
And I think you will see an acceleration in that trend. It's an interesting conundrum. Most businesses become more profitable or less costly by economies of scale. So it becomes like cheaper and cheaper to make an iPhone, right? Mm-hmm. As you go down. Do you remember the dark and past when you bought your first computer compared with what it costs today? It was a fortune, right?
Oh, yeah. It was a big event.
Yeah, it was right, really. But education doesn't get delivered like that, because education, it's like healthcare, it's very much face-to-face.
Mm-hmm.
So 80 to 90% of the cost of running a university is in salaries. And if you double the number of students and you want to keep the class sizes down, you have to double the number of faculty, so you double your costs, right? Mm-hmm. This is why education is so expensive, because it's basically based on people, not on products and on technology. And so it, you know, it's a big employer, but it's also a very fragile employer.
Do you see that in, you know, just like how we were talking about food systems and broadband? I mean, does this create like the opportunity to rethink the system?
I think so. I mean, many would say it, maybe opportunity is the wrong term, but it's something we're going to have to do.
A necessity?
Yeah, it's a necessity, I think. So online education done well, right? That doesn't just mean like we're doing now, you know, basically a long talk on a screen, but where you've really changed your material so it's delivered in smaller time chunks, a lot of feedback, a lot of tracking on what students do. That can deliver content really well, yeah? So you mm-hmm. can learn your biology. You can learn quite a lot of skills. What you don't get is the social side and that the side we were talking about earlier. And so I think what a number of universities are going to have to start looking at is can they almost split their education so that we start delivering content in a very cost-effective way, but we use our professors much more strategically for trying to do that sort of civic side, that building teams, building a sense of what it means to be a responsible citizen, what it means to be curious, and you know, how, what does it take to be a good scientist, right?
Is there a case too, and we got a few minutes here before we'll have to wrap up, but is there a case where, kind of two-part question, like what are the decision points for kind of reopening, you know, kind of the, you know, that Chatham's taking or some of the other colleges, universities in the region? But that leads to my second part of the question is there opportunities for inner institution collaboration? Like, is there a Pittsburgh standard or kind of opportunities that all the, you know, we mentioned Peachy, for example, but like, is there an opportunity there that the United Front exists or kind of a shared space?
So the way you reopen, I think every university is following the governor's sort of traffic light system. And I don't see universities opening on the ground until we hit green. Mm. And almost certainly all of them are going to be doing what Chatham is likely to be doing, an opening, but with social distancing. And, you know, the Peachy presidents, so these are the sort of half dozen major universities in Pittsburgh. They've been talking every week. They have at least once a week phone conference, how they move forward. And all coming up with fairly similar plans. You've got to remember, we're also all in competition with each other, right?
Sure.
The number of students of university going age in Eastern America is going down. Us baby boomers didn't do our job, right? We didn't have enough kids. So we are competing in the traditional market for a dwindling market. What's going to be interesting is how we implement this new style of education. So say everybody's got to wear face masks. We need to do regular temperature checks so we can spot when somebody's temperature is going to go up. If somebody gets ill, we need to do contact tracing. We're going to have to do social distancing. So all these things, for me, what I'm interested in is how can we do that and make that an educational opportunity at university? So the easy way to do it is to impose it, to say, thou shalt do A, B, and C, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I can vaguely remember being a teenager, and that I know exactly what I would have done when people tell me, you know, right, of course I'm not going to do it, right? I'm going to rebel. So what I think we're going to try and do is how do we get a way that students can get involved in this? Okay, so the temperature checking, maybe it should be somebody in the class who's responsible, and they decide who's responsible for checking temperatures that day or that week. And maybe that data we can be gathering, we can be using that in our lessons, right? The social distancing. Okay, but let's come up with some creative ways of signing that around campus. Face masks. I mean, I'm just waiting for the first sort of fashion catwalk experience of face masks, right? Because they're now the must-have accessory.
Right.
Okay. Like I don't do fashion. Okay. I've got no color sense whatsoever. But if I did, I'd be on this like a shot. There's got to be profit in this. Fashionable face masks. So why aren't we having our students design face masks?
So almost like that you're creating a learning experience for the students, right?
Exactly. Because in a sense, and we did this at the end of last semester, our students were saying, when we talk about sustainability, we talk about building in resilience, we talk about the need to be flexible and adaptable and to understand that, you know, you often won't know what the crisis is until it hits you. And then you've got to think in system terms to cope with it. So we had them studying the COVID crisis and what was going on in their community as part of their education, as the semester was ending. And I guess I just think it's part of our job at universities to almost think of everything, you know, where's the learning moment in this? How can I convert this from being a pain in the neck to something that's maybe if not exciting, at least tolerable? Yeah.
Do you think that's a strategy too so universities only have so much control over students when they're on campus, right? So, I mean, just thinking about how many students potentially live, maybe not at Chatham, but live off campus.
Yeah.
Frat parties, for example, do you think that engaging them up front on campus will help to permeate, into life off campus, I guess?
I think it will. And even if I didn't know whether it did or did not work, I would say we have a responsibility to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because it's a due diligence thing, right? If we're saying we have to model what we expect our students to do, and that includes not having parties every weekend or whatever, we have to have those messages out loud and clear. And I also just think kids are inventive. They will come up with ways of doing things that we'd never thought of to survive in these times. Yeah. I mean, I'm 65, so most of my brain's dead now, right? So you got to let kids take the lead.
Well, maybe one last final question then. We can use what's remaining of your brain there there's been a lot of talk about, the COVID crisis presents this systemic opportunity. I mean, I saw something the other day about, a call for a similar, just to build on this last piece of the conversation, like the Civilian Conservation Corps that was created in the Great Depression and, following the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, there was a whole host of kind of social systems engineering that kind of came out of it. What's one of the things that Peter Walker would kind of focus in on in terms of what are some of the things that could help catapult us to a better society?
Well, I think there are two, and these are things that I'm already seeing other countries focus on. So if you watch those countries in Europe that are coming out or think they're coming out of this crisis now, there is an awful lot of talk of this is the opportunity to rework our economy to a more greener economy,
mm-hmm.
To look at moving more rapidly to renewable energy. Because nobody argues that we need it at some point. It's just mathematics. Oil will run out. It's just a matter of when, right? And how much profit you need to get out of it before you abandon it. So I think that's one trend we'll see. The other thing that I think has come out in every country and more so in the States is most developed countries, we thought we had health systems. and we don't. We've got pockets that don't join up. And I think that's the one thing that this crisis has really shown, that we're just not doing joined up writing in our healthcare. It's all these little individual pockets, and it's not actually that difficult to join it up. It would have been way more difficult a generation ago, but with the technology we have now, it's a lot easier to do it. And I think if there was one, if that would be for me the one change, if we could actually build a national health system. I mean, that doesn't mean it has to be government run. It doesn't mean it has to be a service. It can still be a for-profit system, but it's a national system which allows data to be shared, which allows inventories to be shared, which allows us to act like grown-ups, to put it bluntly.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. Well, we appreciate that, your thoughts, Peter, and the guidance that you provide us. This has been absolutely terrific. I want to thank Rebecca Kiernan, our principal resilience planner, and Bill, Joy, and Alex, our production team. This has been the COVID at first COVID episode of the Grant Street Experience. More to come in the next coming days. We have some great guests on cue to help kind of continue this conversation. Thank you for listening in. And Peter, once again, thanks for joining us today.
No, thanks to you. And thanks to the family behind me for putting off the baking for half an hour or so. We're doing a lot more baking now that we're all stuck indoors.
Well, hopefully we get the day that we can share some of those some of those baked goods with you. So
bring you some bread next time.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll talk to you all soon. Take care.
Thanks,
bye for now.